Mia Davis has had a long association with Ledbury Poetry Festival, so it seems only right that she should be reading here today from her first book-length collection, All Fours, published last year by me at Blood Axe. This is described as a book of rituals in language that stalk the space between what is uttered and what is meant. Neera is editor of Poetry Wales, and ritual poetry is the subject of the magazine's latest issue, to be featured in the Ritual Poetry event, which follows this one in the Burgage Hall at 3 o'clock, as well as in an air burial ceremony of poems at the Baptist Hall this evening. And for more details of that, please consult the programme. The poems in Neera's collection, All Fours, are haunted by the strange traces of the longest words in the world, and folk mythic figures such as Sinbad, Eurydice, Mossy Coat, Pan, and Baba Yaga. They pose riddles with multiple or mysterious answers. The book was shortlisted for the Roland Mathias Poetry Award in the 2018 Wales Book of the Year Awards, and has had some marvellous responses from reviewers, including in Planet. Neera Davis performs a dance of the seven veils, with arms, legs, and various other body parts flashing into view. Sex, bodies, explicit language, and a sense of feminist social anger are some of the features that emerge. And the TLS said, profane and charismatic, lovely, and at times infuriating. I don't think that refers to Neera herself, but to her poems, but maybe it could, as you're about to discover. Would you please welcome Neera Davis?
Thank you. Diolch. If you go west, if you go west, you will eventually, undoubtedly find shore. We travel and travel, sleep in the dunes, dine under bridges. You keep your thimble-shaped night lamp close. You store so many berries in my tin cup, fountainous hunger, unprofessional foraging. Hold on. You tell me, hold on to our plain talk, wheels on the cinder, knuckle rocks for tent pegs. But summer is such a drag on us bones. I can smell the resin unscrubbed from my face. I sing, happy birthday to me, sweet melting hot land, or sweet sea, when it comes out of the haze, the interior smoking behind us. That was a poem for the weather. So, I will read some poems from the kind of fairy tale, mythical figure section of the book. These poems are inspired by having a grandmother who was a storyteller and brought me up telling all kinds of different stories from around the world. Anansi the Spider-Man, Baba Yaga, Sinbad, quite a lot of the ancient Greeks there too. So this is for her, Lizzie. I'll read some of these poems. About me. And this is a poem for including the Selkies of the Western Isles, which was one of the stories my grandmother told, which actually made me cry. I remember this. And then she had to sweep him back up and say, no, he didn't kill the seal after all. About me. Because I was sleeping all over here and here, the magnesium intake nightly, the slosh of road in the distance, heaven had already soiled me. Who's that scaling the terrace garden? I opened one eye in the dark, and then someone braver opened both. I made to swing out of a lime tree, said deepen, foster. Thought of when I was young, I would think Selkies, think scary calf. I would listen through lids, less scathing, less scrape and tangle. An alarm sounded and everyone ignored it. I think that was one of the most infuriating poems for the reviewer, because it's called About Me and reveals probably very little about me. Or maybe it does. I'm sure it reveals something about me unconsciously. With Sinbad. He was salty lip to a fault. Safe until they mentioned the singularity. They mean the shiny clarity. And then they mentioned dog. They mean God. And made great commotion in the halls. Did their hymns and rites. I said, oh, dog, no. He was never about this. They misunderstood him. And then they put me to bed like a babe Moses, so I can't protest. Did he talk untidily? Did he howl at his moon all glottal stops and decrossed T's? Did he persevere entirely unbeknown? He had a stoopy grace, made a rimshot off the island in a rinky-dink bark. We tried to kiss on the parapet. I tried to play my sophisticated ailment. The band played Diggy Diggy. We had to row farther and farther out. When I died, I knew he'd have to come with me. And then these two poems are for Orpheus and Eurydice, and they're inspired by other Orpheus poems, of which I'm sure you know there is many. My necklace is just dangling at the wrong place on the lectern. Let's take it off. So, two poems. The first one is called I Know Dissent Lives in the Word Decent, which is from a Terence Hayes poem. And the other one is And Blow in the God's Good Wake to Leave Only Pounded Dust, which is from a poem by Sarah Howe. Both poems about Orpheus. I know dissent lives in the word decent. Orpheus controlled the whips himself and in the all right hasty. He could access the windy sleep within a sleep. Could turn upon Sinjar, his eyes streaming, say, I and I, totally dreadless and still be alight. Silver birch and slow gin, just to be decent to one another, make a quiet life in the aftermath, tell memories of future mammies, future tea and scones, he may have considered this. He may have considered turning whip into harp string and placing us in the tail within a tail. Or to open us up as a precipice to look into what I could be if I could just imagine myself as a woman, he might have thought, but it's hard. When he opened his eyes, they were burning. There was a window into an aftermath. I take this window to be a ladder. Admit yourself to the decent life. And blow in the God's good wake to leave only pounded dust. When he touched my cheek like that, the vibration he made, how did I not laugh right back in his ear? But instead, the ill scent that felt well won or well worn, I'd take his army of birds, his spell-breaking death already in him, I'd take it. Pity the shreds of him he became. I'd take it. His spell-breaking death already in him. Pity the mortal killed by women, I'd take it. Feathers in shreds, foretaste tasted like metals. Some sibilance in his last number of the night. This is a poem about drowning or a botched rescue, where the rescuer sings of himself. Mossy Coat. Mossy Coat is the gypsy version of Cinderella. She's a bit like Cinderella, but a lot more exciting and assertive and aggressive. I was going to say badass, but that wouldn't sound quite right in my mouth. So Mossy Coat, her mother makes her a magic coat made out of fine magic moss that she can go into the world and repel all of the advances of unwanted men, and then turn up at the ball and get everything she desires. Mossy coat. I wanted to live out of party bags and dream daily in bread-making references. I wanted to write about haunted styes and brown trousers, the look of champagne on your face, the look of right nice, right nice. I would write about sealing practices, I said. I wanted Ermintrude or any woman by that name to come to my party. I thought about how I'd like pieces of his muscles to keep for the night. I wouldn't waste them. And of course, I thought about Mossycoat. She singles out the bad men, the ghosts from the guests, hears Baba Yaga's distant rumble. I wanted the bad man to come back and fetch me. I wanted the loom as a bed. I said my time with me should be limited. I wanted masochistic dressing up mode. And I wanted furlongs of him. And pussy was a word I could think about. Pussy, cunt, mossy, coat, or maybe a rap on the word sundress. I couldn't think about I anymore, it was bad for me. So I thought about him all dressed up like a pig herder or a mountain lion. And about wedges and about my moccasin together look with a heel. Look, Pocahontas, look. But instead, I hadn't put my trousers on. I wasn't sporting either. I just thought about Mossycoat and how she was a good role model for me, especially for finding the right man and leaving him with the right shoe. I wanted Baba Yaga to come and eat me up. I wanted to come over as a nasty piece of work, especially as a piece of work, and also that he'd be shocked at what I'd become. Personality-wise, I wanted to be a mismatched underwear set. Certainly, I was keen to become a burden. I can't help the way I feel, I said, especially when it comes to spanking. And what would my mother think about what I'd become in the coat she made me out of moss, that fine, magic moss? I thought about death briefly but regularly and not in a suicidal way. I have been managing fine by myself, I said to him. I only joke when I say I need you as my butler. Poem with sex, all fours. And Susan Sontag once said, sex is not a project. Okay, I want to stand here. Sex as the universal human baseline. Sex as solid, rockable. Sex as a species in-joke. Sex as the one becalmer, the mashing thing. The underside of sex topples, and I share a space with that thought. Sex as the great destroyer and creator, as the opposite of death drive. The ex libris of sex is a palm with a word or a letter on it. I search piano and open on Pinterest. Sex is happening even when you think it isn't. I like Tamara's piano and it's not a metaphor. Desire as inextinguishable smoulder and chief cliche, the notion of so much sex as taunting versus not living because of sex. The door opens automatically. The word romantic has returned. What does sex without love have in common with love without sex? For the past 10 minutes, I have not been thinking about sex to write this. The weather of sex is not only notional. The humidity and restraint, the flicker and boom, the rules of its own and its knife edge. It's for you to enjoy, but it's not like butter biscuits or stacked books, a closet full of quality garments. sex as the open sesame, sexual fantasy as trolling of the self and auto-relief, eros plasticity of the self, and card games on trains with vodka and sweat. This was not a planned sex, this was cod love. Dunno, it's like a stick of rock on the beach, and that has nothing to do with our sex life. Sex is rocking the ocean liner and leaving itself at high tide everywhere. The shamey side of things. We don't know how to feel about your arousal at embarrassment. It's not common to give one's parents a commentary on one's sex life. In the anechoic chamber of the word perfect love, sandwiches and crisps, love is not really a buttonhole or a mouse, but I'm sure comparisons have been made. We've come to define ourselves against others and a mint cocktail. And, contrary to what is assumed, woman is not in charge of all breeding matters. The cheek offered is separate and fulsome, still shiny from crying. I should have cried more in the attic room. It was so bright and moths and rugs. And this is not a good place to lie down in. And I should have chosen better linen. But we didn't have a maid. And what is the source anyhow? The source is dying. No shit, the sea moves. This is a new poem. No shit, the sea moves. I know a thing or two about being outside. Watch what happens. The wind makes me lightheaded, shedding, pulling, shedding mundane, fantasized encounters. No shit, the sea moves. A coughing from the cave, don't make work for the lifesavers. In antiquity, the lifesavers wore nothing but orange skin. We organ grind and hold pegs in our hands. A common reason for divorce after 10 years is lack of shared interests. I wondered how long the sea would take to join hands behind that rock. As long as it took me to write this. A word in your shell like, the ear, the shell like. Bed worn. Tied to the oracle pull of strange flowers, something sails. Green beads on a black background. Scurrilous shapes, marvel vine. We doze in an old kind of nourished. Then there is your Farsi nature. Some think you are averse to the neutral catch-all of spring, rivers, such things. I say summer is all honey hive on our cliff and that the seals of the Black Sea are different. And what about my intertragic notch? Fear. Do you love so? I love so. Purring wonders come out of you, spoon-eared. Wanton soup is delivered, so tragic as to be intertragic. Old soft lobes, you really test me. It is not sufficient to be waiting like this. Is it? A cold shoulder of lamb. And when I wheeze like this, you can feel my pollen. Nightjar hands. I mean that they are cold. You've been washing in soil again. And I've become the seventh sea, a waiting child, waiting for a child, waiting for you to be an adult. The book entitled Three Ways to Make It could be made from any number of perfectly good trees. The Christmas wreath has not been taken down by us or anyone else. You put most latitudes down to wanting to visit. Nightlife is a loneliness machine. I think of the light shifting from pole to pole, and if you were to walk from Arctic to equator, you would find a very long walk, but a good walk. Medicinal waiting, floral waiting, born waiting, waiting to not be your mother but someone else's. What would life as a lawnmower be like? What would life in the grass be like? I circle the balustrade once to tell you I am still waiting. A lamb is white because it is so, but it can also be brown, having been cooked so. There is kitchen conversation, and then there is kitchenette conversation. You can have my travel bags full of adapter plugs. My lungs have also gathered tacky stickers from all the visits and the visitations. It's possible I have the right kind of night, but I am rotten when I think straight. One more new poem I'm going to try and remember. It's also a hot weather poem. It's called Gash Panic. You need to get your angry face ready. Anything could happen in November, like war. I'm going to write a prize-winning poem about the war, and then I can die happy with my face, my angry face, set back to neutral. Dignity, Rachmaninoff, I can't imagine dying to contemporary music. These days, we can all feel some war zone amplitude. Hate, hate and confusion of hate. Burny weather, forest fires. My friends in love don't notice the hate. The cities wrapped, erupted, convulsed, ferris. Which way is up now? These days we can all feel some war zone amplitude. It's hot in these cities I've heralded. It's hot in these cities I've loved. Okay, this is a poem about a composer called Victor Ullmann, and he died in the death camps in the Holocaust, in the Shoah, and he was brought back to life, supposedly, by a medium by the name of Rosemary Brown, who claimed that she could communicate with dead composers, such as Chopin, and write their kind of lost, forgotten works for them, or she used to also sometimes make adjustments that the composers had thought about after dying. And in 1974, she was brought back, she brought back Victor Ullmann to help Kerry Woodward with a performance of his opera. So this is a poem for Victor Ullmann and his medium, Rosemary Brown. All the panna cotta and ribbons. So why be so angry? He says our hands are busted Ferris wheel, and I'm ventriloquizing him. That's an accusation. I do telly-side professional bitching. But you can pet me while my pelt is still warm. I got myself a grilling on the internet while Nathalia Romanenko did his number 25. Keep going, keep going. My Morris Minor ankles do nothing for me in desert boots. Too chill. And I feel pretty futile. He even made posthumous tweaks. It's 1975 and he's invited back. He makes harp, harpsichord. And it's as if he was alive all along, was only hiding in the furthest chamber. Blancmange was on my mind, to buffer and stuff me from any painful thoughts or stench, death camp, mediate all day and nobody thanks me for it. He made love all day and nobody thanked him for it. Knew the chats of Chopin were for nothing. He made swallowed sleigh bell warm. Nathalia gazing, curtsying, we are too broken, broken to make this work. I should shout, don't be pessimistic, don't indulge in the present. I keep ice cream for miracle usage. I internalise, oh, just be happy, happy, and move on. Of course, the other medium is me. I forgot to tell you, there's more than one medium. Okay, just do one more poem. This is called Hello Beautiful. I'm very interested in the hidden rooms inside ourselves and the hidden selves, the unconscious. This is a poem that kind of seems to summon some kind of creepy person. I didn't know who it was, and then I, of course, realised it must be a version of myself, which is quite disturbing, but that makes poetry for you. Hello, beautiful. How is our symbiosis, our stutter? Look at me calling over to you. I'm made of signs and fast forwards. I'm lending you my ear and my cheek. Did you ever even have a stomping ground? Tell me how that was possible, even minutely. We can talk. I can take pictures of you at the fruit machine. Your clavicles wonder me in that glow. Hello, beautiful. Science is a bitch. It takes so long to prove anything. It takes and it takes. Can you believe me that I am nothing but your other insider? Nothing if not yours. Your other half-life. And I've bought you a juicer. Dear beautiful, head yourself over onto my lap. Heave over here to my saucer. In the forest, there are rarities and clearings I've seen from above. Don't worry yourself with lures. You can be Vasilisa, Red Riding Hood. You'll find me here, wolf and witch. Dear delight, I am curried and cusp. I am litres of seawater, selfish, as you know. Grand light in the bay, and there are partial bites on your skin. I am nothing if not a defender of you. How can one subsist on barley alone? How can one hope to live at all? I keep saying little miss, like it really is something. I keep preserving these lemons, hoping one day you will try them. Dear beautiful, remember me? I am waiting to be your thin thing. I am already your insides. I am already a firm believer. Thank you.
Caroline Bird has published 5 collections of poetry with Carcanet, her first in 2002 when she was only 15, when she launched that book at Ledbury, and was 45 minutes late for her own reading because she was stuck on the motorway. There were no mobiles then to let people know, but people hung on to her and they heard her read. That book was Looking Through Letterboxes, a topical, zesty, and formally delightful collection of poems built on the traditions of fairy tale, fantasy, and romance. This was followed in 2006 by her second collection, Trouble Came to the Turnip, the title poem of which is a tour de force, and I'm sure many people know it. It's a particular favourite of mine. Her third, Watering Can, celebrates life as an early 20-something with comedy, wordplay and bright self-deprecation, and was followed by The Hat Stand Union, described by Simon Armitage as spring-loaded, funny, sad and deadly. You don't know if a bullet will come out of the barrel or a flag with a word bang on it. Her fifth collection, In These Days of Prohibition, published in 2017, saw her switching from surreal satire to seeking simple truth. Venturing into the badlands of the human psyche, her poems hold their subjects in an unflinching grip, addressing faces behind the veneer, asking what it is that keeps us alive. These days of prohibition are days of intoxication and inebriation, rehab in the Arizona desert, and adultery for atheists, until finally Bird edges us out of danger, revving on a wish. In These Days of Prohibition was shortlisted for both the T.S. Eliot Prize and the Ted Hughes Award. Bill Herbert, chair of the T.S. Eliot Prize judges, called the book equally pleasurable and disturbing because it understands the genuinely strange ground on which we must build our thoughts and our emotions. In work of great and frequently comic poise, it captures moments of absolute loss of control and absolute freedom. We recognise that sustained, unsettling comic virtuosity is the startling agent by which we engage with such loss, such freedom. And to quote Simon Armitage again, Bird is irrepressible. She simply explodes with poetry. As Ella Fitzgerald might have sung in her lullaby, whisper low, kiss me sweet, then we'll go flying high in Birdland. Prepare for takeoff.
Hello. I'm going to begin with a poem in the form of a quiz. You can answer the questions in your head. If you answer yes to one or more, that means you're in my club. It's called Patient Intake Questionnaire. I think they start off easy and then get harder. Do you taste pepper whilst eating ice cream? Do sandwiches appear intricately designed? Do you think of waterfalls when lighting a match? Have you started to look at pigeons like they know something? Do you think about your chin when you are kissing? Can you feel the blood in your thumb? Do your eyebrows feel like stickers? Do you look twice at your name on a letter? Does your hair hurt? When barefoot, do your shoes feel too tight? Can you sense the tiny holes in the cotton of your shirt? Do you peel bananas fearfully in case there is no banana inside? Does the ceiling occasionally ripple? Has your pillow developed a strange echo? Does your neck feel like a bone? Do you hear sex noises through the wall when standing in a field? So, I wrote started writing that poem about actually 10 years ago. When after a series of unenjoyable adventures, I ended up in this rehab in the middle of the desert. And the first thing they do when you get to one of these institutions, they give you a patient intake questionnaire full of these horrifically simple questions about how you've been harming yourself and how often. But it's precisely at the moment in your life where you don't want to be honest about or simple about anything. So I went back to my room and I translated the test into a poem. And so a question like, have you ever experienced a psychotic episode, became, have you started to look at pigeons like they know something? And then the counsellor found out I'd been doing this with all of the paperwork, right? And we had this little confrontation, which then I remembered a few years back, and I wrote this little sonnet, which is much shorter than my introduction. It's called A Surreal Joke. 1 year is blank on my curriculum vitae. I was in the desert, convalescing, repairing my septum, I'd tried to die expensively, dragging it out over 6 months, locked in my university bathroom with a rolled up scrap of Canto. I forgot how to love my family. At one point, my arms turned completely blue. My assigned counsellor told me I used poetry to hide from myself, unhook the ballast from my life, a floating ruse of surreal jokes. He stole my notebook. I said, they're not jokes. He said, maybe try to write the simple truth. I said, why? But that relationship with the simple truth, I think it's really interesting, because like so often people think, oh, poets, they just want to tell the truth. But actually, it's like, well, you want to confess things, but without having to give away any of the facts. That's why you dress it up in ideas and images. And, you know, there's this kind of like hiding as well as revealing. Because sometimes that feels more real than the facts. So this next poem is all true, but contains no facts. It's called Bipolar Purgatory. Hey! I've got a theme song in my tooth, Tabasco spleen, a reason to say halcyon. A cobbler on speed dial who specialises in stretchy glass slippers. An honorary degree from the Hot Pink Sensorium. Two tickets for literally every aeroplane, all laid atop the chiffon in my valise. But right now, I'm thinking about moonstruck linen, beaded skin, a lover swallowed by my sighing, or maybe I'm planning a heist. It's hard to tell. With my hood up and sunglasses, shivering in sweatpants, etc. But I am a neon fish. Interstellar anomaly. Undercover angel sent to test you. Yes, please do admire these greasy knots in my hair, like precious gems dipped in chip fat, or perspiring padlocks, or these dirt-smeared stars dangling above me. Look, that my limbo support team say I have to polish back to shining brilliance using only a J-cloth and cleansing teardrops for my congruent mind before I ascend any higher. Well, you know, if you want to write about madness, it makes sense to do it madly, right? That's the only sane way of going about it. But then sometimes the truth is so surreal, if you turned it into a dream, you would be making it tamer. So this is true. Yeah, this is called a poem called Stephanie. She was 18, used party as a verb, lashes like the whiskers of an oil-soaked seal, devoured books with names like Steamy LA Nights Under the Duvet by Flashlight. I was 23, brooding over John Ashbery between therapy sessions, hunched at the smoker's table like a misunderstood genius. I was recovering from a bout of goodbye world. We were both diligent pleasers. I fell in love with the reflection of someone charming in her sunglasses. I always wanted to be charming. I forgot we were ill. When I finally touched her, her skin dilated. She shuddered, licked her teeth, and crawled towards me across the bed. It was like watching a child possessed by the vengeful spirit of a murdered porn star. I locked myself in the bathroom and then strode to the nurse's station to confess. Afterwards, my counsellor said, "We really dropped the ball on this one, placing a sex addict in a room with a lesbian." She wrote me a 10-page love letter in red ink. The nurses tried to lull my guilt. If an alcoholic screams for a whiskey, it's not the bartender's fault if he pours. I didn't like being compared to booze, like I could have been anyone. The acne-scarred chef who grinned at her once, the pin-eyed new boy, the mouthy car washer at the NA meeting, like it was just because she was a nympho and I was her roomie and nothing to do with real electricity, or Stephanie somehow spying the part worth saving in me. So there's a lot of poems in the book about kind of different ways of trying to deny things and hide things and put a front on things. And even when I was not able to write what felt simple or true, I would try and write about the process of hiding it, if that makes sense. And my mum's boyfriend often tells these long anecdotes, and sometimes you'll wake up halfway through one and think, oh, that's actually quite interesting what you're saying. And he would tell me about the SS Richard Montgomery, which was a warship that crashed off the Isle of Shippey in 1940. And it's still under the water, and it's got all the explosives still in it, but the port authorities don't want to move it because then it could explode. But the thing about bombs underwater is the longer you leave them there, the more likely they are to explode. And the surrounding people got a bit concerned. So on their Wikipedia page in 2009, the port authorities released a statement saying, just one line says there, "Doing nothing is not an option for much longer." That's it. I haven't said anything since. I just thought that was just so fantastically weak. Yeah. Anyway, I thought it was quite a good metaphor for a secret. You know, it's too dangerous to shift, but the longer you don't... Anyway, this is the sonnet that's, again, much shorter than my intro. It's called SS Suppression. An unexploded warship sits on my seabed. Each dissolving day hardens the risk. New cracks appear in the hull, stripping the vessel to its naked cargo. Waves tremble. Fish play chicken. Anything could blow it. One glance of a snorkeler's flipper. Or time alone, no reason, like blurting a secret. Ignore a bomb long enough, it'll learn self-release. Port authorities repeat, doing nothing is not an option for much longer. That's it. So the book's called In These Days of Prohibition, right? And I remember seeing this quote from the American novelist John Dos Passos, and he said that during Prohibition, it was really difficult to get a cup of tea in Greenwich Village because every type of tea was a code name for gin. And I just love, talk about kind of flimsy fronts. I love this idea of everyone just sitting around drinking from their teacups and everyone just knowing that everyone else is drinking gin, you know, but not these kind of elaborate and yet completely transparent disguises. So this is a poem called In These Days of Prohibition. Once the needle hits the record, it doesn't take much more than a bottle and two chairs to make a speakeasy. I am a ratified woman. There's no bulge in my bootleg. I only ducked into this doorway to get out of the wet. I know the cost of indiscretion, the tonsil hit of ardent spirits, the mobster trucks that reach the coast empty, come back sloshing, the difference an evening makes. Once the needle hits the record, it doesn't take much. Purely out of interest, if we swilled but didn't swallow, would we circumvent the law? Silly question. Cancel that order. It's a school night. Plus, personal liberty means more than a bottle and two chairs in some speakeasy. Sure, the whiskey rebellion's recruiting, and who hasn't hankered for rough moonshine? But mix the sunset with glycerine and juniper berry, the dawn'll smell it on you. Am I a ratified woman? Is that a bulge in your bootleg? And even if, behind my ear, a magic button could revert this whole place back into a billiard saloon, I'd still clink in the basement of myself. I should go. This water tastes strong. I ducked into this doorway to get out of the wet. Go home to your chosen professional, your stoic nurse, your abiding baker. Why thirst for untried concoctions? Wordlessness erodes us, and this bottle has no label. I'll forget whom I belong to once the needle hits the record. And then I love silences after poems, don't you? I feel like you can't be a poet unless you really enjoy uncomfortable silences. You know, and there's kind of like little like different exhales of breath and you know, it's great. I like it. It's like it's movable air. So I think there's two different types of, it's a creak there, isn't it? Two different types of front that you put on. You have that one that's just like denial where it's easy because you don't know what you're even feeling yourself. And then there's another one where it's more like the facade of a house where the rest of you is just under reconstruction. So you have to have something there, you know, just as a kind of placeholder. For yourself. This is a poem called 42 Veneer Avenue. Imagine a hologram fire, paper angels stuck to fake frosted windows, snow-sugared roof, a creaking weather vane featured in the film score, epiphany motif like a harpist trill, bling. Picture a broad porch, generic actor coming home for Christmas with a necessary speech. Shiny tower of gifts balanced under his lantern chin. That is my house, as seen from the street. Behind the front where I live, it's mostly scaffolding, audio equipment. I sit cross-legged in the sawdust, clutching a mic. Daddy's home, mummy. My domain is domestic sound effects. Ghosts of the throat. Sweet impressions. On clear days, Still, I imagine you'll come knocking at my door to meet me in person. So there is some kind of glimmers of hope towards the end of the book, and I was interested in this idea of trying to become congruent, you know, trying to meet yourself. And then I came across this article in The Guardian about this new radical type of marriage, which is definitely, you know, seemed to be about becoming one with yourself, perhaps excessively. And I thought it'd be a good way to start exploring what that meant. This is a poem called Meghan Married Herself. She arrived at the country mansion in a silver limousine. She'd sent out invitations and everything. Her name written twice with a and in the middle. The calligraphy of coupling. She strode down the aisle to At Last by Etta James. Faced the celebrant like a keen soldier reporting for duty. Her voice shaky, yet sure. I do. I do. You may now kiss the mirror. Applause. Confetti. Every single one of the 140 guests deemed the service unimprovable. Especially the vows, so from the heart. Her wedding gown was ivory, pointedly off-white. After all, we have shared a bed for 32 years. She quipped in her first speech. So I'm hardly virginal, if you know what I mean. No one knew exactly what she meant. Not a soul questioned their devotion. You only had to look at them, hand cupped in hand, smiling out of the same eyes. You could sense their secret language, bone deep, blended blood. One guest eyed his wife hovering harmlessly at the bar and imagined what his life might have been if he'd responded years ago to that offer in his head. I am the only one who will ever truly understand you. Marry me, Derek. I love you. Marry me. At the time, he hadn't taken his proposal seriously. He recharged his champagne flute, watched the newlywed cut her five-tiered cake, both hands on the knife. Is it too late for us to try? Derek whispered to no one. As the bride glided herself onto the dance floor, taking turns first to lead, then follow. Have you ever been like crying, like proper crying in the bathroom, you know, and then suddenly you'll catch sight of yourself in the mirror and you'll think, oh my God, I'm so sad. And for a second, there's a moment of reprieve because you're just like suddenly stunned by your own authenticity, you know. And you're like, whoa, look at, you know. And it's and then obviously you go back to being sad. But it's very different, isn't it, from how in those old black and white films they have just the one solitary tear that just dies for the sins of your mascara, you know. And this is how my brain works. I was thinking about that one solitary tear and what the politics might be with all the other tears and, you know, how they get on. So this is a poem called The Military Life of a Maverick Teardrop. Venturing out, uncharted skin, the moon face of a cheek, the precipice of a chin, our very own Captain Oates of the tear duct tent. I am just going outside. I may be some time. Yes, solitary tear, we thank you for your service. Individualist, luminary, brief candle, our saline saint of acceptable sorrow. For years you hid us from the world's horrors, tissue boxes, snot, shame. You held us back for our protection, solitary tear. But now we must respectfully beg you relinquish that role, sir, and rejoin our ranks, because the sobbing situation's crazy out there. In the bedroom, study, lounge, it shows no sign of resolution. All night long we hear fresh tears screaming in squash slang, sliding, colliding, they do not wait their turn for the dive anymore. Spill out 10 at once, some must shed and splat, never even knowing what it was they wept for. This is no longer a job for an embroidered hanky, comrades. The time has come for us all to shine. Thank you. And then, talking about kind of, yeah, meeting yourself, I then saw this thing, like, obviously I'm going to explain it at length in the poem, but I think it's probably one of the best things I've ever seen with my outer eyes, and it's a... made me realise that I was ready to write some slightly happier poems, because sometimes it's about what you notice. Like, if you've kind of got a whole cloud over you, you don't notice the material that produces the poems about joy, you know, because you're not able to see through your own, you know, dirty windscreen. So this is my last poem. It's a bit longer, but thank you very much. It's called A Toddler Creates Thunder by Dancing on a Manhole. At first, she cannot account for the noise. With each jerked step, a thunderclap, her metal dance floor echoes her jive. Her pumps, no bigger than mini croissants, each creates a cymbal crash. The earth responds to her slightest step. What dark sorcery is this? What topsy-turvy witchcraft? She pauses to evaluate a scientific test. She retreats to the grass, jumps, no thunder. She jumps back on the manhole, thunder. She sees her powers are site-specific, unique to this one patch. She returns to her sacred sphere, a pint-sized Jedi embracing the force. I see it happen in her face. From this beer garden bench, book propped, ornamental in my hands, I see her eyes spin like stop signs, red to green. Now she cannot be silenced. Prospero in rainbow leggings. Stormlord. She gambols fitfully on her audible stage. Toddlers always dance like marionettes, their brains still learning the strings. The men behind me are quaffing hipster ales. I just don't want to feel shit in terms of... There's never a good way to end it. Daisy, I mean, she's fine. I turn my phone face down on the table. But what's this? A swerve in the plot. A second child. Same face. Same rainbow leggings. Approaches the rim of the arena. A sidelined gladiator. This is mythological. Siblings dueling over the tempest touch, yet within the magic circle there is room for only one. The twin hovers her trainer over the metal. She pauses, draws back. I see her thinking, what if I can't replicate the sound? Her logic doesn't focus on the manhole, its looseness, percussive material, the reasons for the noise, but rather on her sister's ability to conjure it. For the twin, it is not guaranteed just anyone could make this dance floor sing, or that her identical weight must yield identical magic. The conclusion is unknown, therefore a risk. A trial of self-belief. She lifts her foot again. I miss my mouth, pour beer down my shirt. Again, she withdraws. Her brow squeezes. A moral flashes through it. And like that, she folds. Cross-legged on the grass, consents to spectate. She will not trespass on her sister's fairy ring, steal her thunder. Oh, the humanity! Generosity unsurpassed! But wait, there's more. She begins to applaud that fleshy infant clap, its value enhanced by the coordinative strain. The hipsters are discussing licorice Rizzler. It's like flavoured smoking. They chortle like scrambled cassette tapes. But look, now the tiny dancer is a celebrity. applauded by her own mirror image, an audience of herself, like that dream where everyone looks like you. I pick up my phone, type "I'm sorry," then delete it. I picture a world of admiring clones, assigned doppelgangers bred solely to approve of unremarkable feats. A second me sat cross-legged on my shadow, shouting, "Bravo! And it's a miracle! She can summon salty water from her eyes!"